I'm Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. Larry Burke, and we're going to talk about his book, Let Magic Happen, Adventures in Healing with the Holistic Radiologist. And man, this is an interesting story to read. If you've not heard of this book, make sure you go and get a copy, because you won't be able to put it down. I've been reading it since about 9 o'clock this morning, and I can't put it down. So how are you, Dr. Burke?
I'm doing good, Eva. Please let everyone call me Larry.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on my show. What a great book. I mean, you and I have known each other for years, and I knew some of these stories, but I didn't know all of them, obviously. And man, is it an amazing path. So tell us a little bit about you, where people can find you, where people can find this book. Tell us what you're doing now and how you started doing the holistic side of what you're doing.
Okay. Well, right now I am have my own consulting company called Healing Imager, Inc., and I do both MRI, musculoskeletal, teleradiology part-time, and I also do emotional freedom techniques, or EFT, and hypnosis part-time. So I've tried to combine two worlds and keep one foot in each world, which has been part of my path that's described in the book. My website is www.letmagichappen.com, and there are lots of previous papers and other articles and interviews that I've put together on the website, as well as information about the book. Two sample chapters, chapter 1 and chapter 7, that are free downloads, and it's available in both paperback and ebook on Amazon.
So what is your website? Where can people find you?
It's www.letmagichappen.com. All one word, let magic happen.
So tell us, how did you get started? I mean, I know how you can get started in radiology. You go to medical school, but you have a little bit different path. You had a father who was a physicist, so you had an interest in science. How on earth did you move from allopathic radiology to more open-minded, holistic medicine?
Well, I think I must have had some interest in high school, because I came to Duke University in 1973 to start my freshman year, and I looked all through the course catalog because I wanted to sign up for a course in parapsychology, but there weren't any, because as it turned out, I discovered later that Dr. Ryan had moved the parapsychology lab off campus in 1964, and I had completely been mistaken that he had any remaining affiliation with Duke. But to be honest, I can't remember any real psychic experiences, intuitive experiences, or interest in healing all through undergraduate pre-med, medical school, radiology, and it really wasn't until I moved to Philadelphia in 1996 that things started to shift for me. And I guess I should mention that during medical school residency, just to give you a sense of how single-minded most physicians are, I was immersed in the radiology literature. I was contributing, writing articles, and doing scientific research. And I read two books those entire 9 years. I read The Witches of Eastwick, and I read The Right Stuff. Those are the only two books I read. And then when I got to Philadelphia, a friend of mine introduced me to my first metaphysical bookstore, and I developed a passion for buying books from my medical physical bookstore, which is called the Garland of Letters, and it is one of the few remaining major metaphysical bookstores in a big city on the East Coast, and I was shocked to discover that the Bodhi Tree bookstore has recently closed in Los Angeles. It was made famous by Shirley MacLaine in a lot of her books. So
I can't believe that. I was so disappointed when I heard that.
Yeah, and so the Garden of Letters is like my Bodhi Tree bookstore, and it was one of my biggest thrills was sending a box of books to the Garden of Letters a couple of weeks ago to sell there. So it's on South Street in Philadelphia, one of the few bookstores that carries my book. So since it's a self-published book. So
tell us a little bit about one of the first things that you got involved with. Was learning about medical intuition and about the power of mind, you know, with your father and some other people that you knew in curing some pretty radical illnesses, which kind of opened your mind to other things. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd say there are probably four or five things that happened to me within that one span of one or two years when I moved to Philadelphia. I spent a year at the University of Pennsylvania. And I knew something was up when all the administrators in the hospital had little crystal pyramids on their desk. And I thought, what are those doing there? And then I realized that the MRI scan facility was housed in a unique pyramid-shaped building, and they had all gotten pyramids to commemorate the founding of that building. And so I was just curious. I thought, this is really strange. You know? And then other things that happened when I moved to Philadelphia, I became a member of the safety committee for the Society for Magnetic Resonance Imaging, and we were concerned with two different aspects of safety in particular. One was what to do with people who are claustrophobic in the MRI scanner, and the second was, were there any health effects from the electromagnetic fields? So those are two big things that got me thinking outside the box. Upon arriving in Philadelphia. Then my dad got cancer, kidney cancer, and I wound up going on a major journey with him through various different alternative therapies over the next 6 years. And that combined with reading the metaphysical bookstores and then starting to meet a lot of people in Philadelphia who were psychic started to break my box wide open. So which of those would you like to talk about first?
You just take off and go. I would like my readers to know your story.
I'd like them to know your
how you started out being pretty much a regular doctor. I'd like them to know about your trials and tribulations, because it's not always easy to walk a path that's a little bit different from the people around you and be able to hold on to it without going crazy. So I'd like to know all of that.
Thinking back, there's an interesting story that connects to my sort of awakening in Philadelphia that happened quite a few years before. Relates to the silly pyramid logos and crystal pyramids in the administrator's office at Penn. I had an intern during my first clinical experience in radiology. Not in radiology, in med school, who started telling me about pyramid power. And, you know, he puts his food under a little pyramid in his house, stays fresh, his razor blades stay sharp. And I thought this was pretty wacky, but it made for entertaining conversation late at night when we were waiting for the next patient to come in. And so that was my introduction to really fringe thing way back in the late 70s. But he then got taken to task by the chairman of medicine because he was talking back in those days. He had a cancer patient and said, I think I should put this patient on selenium. And, you know, selenium was unheard of back in those days as a supplement. Now we recognize it's an important antioxidant. Well, the chairman of medicine just took him to task for that. Said, where'd you get the information? He cited some alternative journal. He said, son, you're reading the wrong literature. So I got to see my first alternative hero squelched in front of me. Is like, this is a warning of things to come. So later, here I am at Penn, one of the most prestigious, you know, universities on the East Coast, and I'm working in a pyramid building. So I finally went and bought my first book from the metaphysical bookstore, which was called The Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins, because I wanted to know more about pyramids and the history of the whole thing. So that started with my first metaphysical book, and it was complete opening of my mind that has continued ever since. And I used to buy a book every week for like the next 2 years and read them.
I'd like to ask you a question about the pyramid thing. I had a friend, in fact, I have a new book coming out next month. It's called Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics. And the man, his name was Dr. Roy Scruggs. He worked at NASA, and he was spiritually awake. I'm sure you know what I mean by that. And he used to talk about this little experiment that they did at NASA. They built this little small pyramid, maybe about, I don't know, 10 or 12 inches tall, and they put a banana in it. And in a few days, I don't remember days or weeks, like, because he's dead now and I can't ask him, that banana petrified. And so, but he always told me the same things. It will keep your razor blade sharp, it will keep your food fresher, but does it matter what you make the pyramid out of? Does it have to be certain specific? I've always wondered that. Now that you know about it, I want to ask.
To tell you the truth, I never explored the pyramid power concept any further after that one episode way back in medical school. What I became more interested in was actually the Great Pyramid itself and all the legendary stories about the King's Chamber in the center of the pyramid and the mythology around who built the pyramid. And that was really what intrigued me the most. And, of course, it may connect back to this whole concept of pyramid power because, people say, well, the King's Chamber was, not actually a tomb. It was designed for other purposes. Maybe it was an initiation chamber. And for me, reading that book was certainly my initiation into the whole metaphysical world. So one of my goals for many years has been to go to Egypt, and I did get to go this past November. My daughter was going to school over there, and I got to go inside the King's Chamber, and it is an amazing cosmic echo chamber that it's probably the most sacred place on Earth. So that was a lifelong goal that I was able to fulfill, and then I realized I was following in the footsteps of Napoleon, Pythagoras, and God knows what other famous figures who had all gone, and some had spent nights meditating in the King's Chamber, and apparently Napoleon had quite a traumatic experience, because I think what you experience in the King's Chamber depends on what you bring in there, and he apparently came out white as a ghost the next morning and didn't want to talk about it.
Can't imagine. Now, I just want to make my listeners aware, you're a highly published author of many medical papers, so you're not just some quack radiologist out there. I mean, you're respected in your field for your medicine work, as well as the things that you've learned about electricity and magnetic fields and healing. So could you talk to us a little bit about electromagnetic fields and healings? And
sure, you're right. I was one of the first radiologists to do research on MRI of the knee and MRI of the shoulder for meniscal tears and rotator cuff tears. And that was way back in the late 80s when MRI was still new. And that was when I also got involved in the safety committee, because the whole field was so pretty much brand new in terms of what the safety issues were in these big magnetic fields. And clearly there are major problems with people bringing metal objects into the scanner, major problems with people have metal in their body that's attracted to the magnet, and then there are many other things, claustrophobia being one of them. And I did join the Bioelectromagnetic Society at that time in the late 80s because I wanted to really talk to the other scientists who were doing the serious research on effects of electromagnetic fields on the body. Because I really was concerned that we were doing some big experiment in the MRI scanner. We didn't really know what effects the magnetic fields might have, and I was just getting introduced to the concept of subtle energies. I had some of my psychic friends say they really didn't like being around the big magnets. And That led me off into going to the Bioelectromagnetic Society meetings and meeting some pretty cutting-edge scientists who were looking at the effects of electromagnetic fields on the cells themselves. And the second book I bought at the Body Electric at the Garden of Letters was The Body Electric by Robert Becker. And that book had a profound influence on me. His research was really respected and eventually led to the development of bone healing with electricity. And being a bone radiologist, I was
particularly interested in that. What did you find about electromagnetic fields? What is your opinion today? Just out of curiosity.
About what?
What did you find about electromagnetic fields? What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, these days, back in the 80s when we were looking into it, magnetic fields were concerns were about power lines causing cancer, police radar causing cancer, childhood leukemia, things like that. And cell phones weren't even on the radar screen, to be honest. But nowadays, the hot topic is really cell phones. And I recently revisited all that literature, and one of my friends who I met back in the 80s, Carl Blackman, was the president of the Bioelectromagnetic Society, and he's still one of the top authorities in the field, and I see him every few months. And they just recently came out with a statement that radio frequencies and electromagnetic fields could be considered a class 2B carcinogen. So that means it's suspected of having some impact on human cancer. And the
you talk about in your book about Leslie Patton and her copper biocircuit.
Oh, yeah.
Work?
In terms
really
of subtle energies, there's a woman who wrote a book called Biocircuits, Leslie Patton, and she found that after going to the MRI scanner, she felt like her magnetic fields were, personal subtle energies were way out of balance. And she had a device called the Biocircuit device that you would hold copper electrodes in your hand and place them on connected to your spine to rebalance the energy. And she felt that she was way out of whack when she got out of the machine, and then took her an hour or so in the Biocircuits to get back in balance.
Is there a way that we can shield ourselves from these fields that you know of?
That's a real good question. In terms of just cell phones themselves, the first thing to do is not hold the cell phone against your ear. That's the number one rule. You can either put it on the speakerphone or just hold it for at least an inch away from your head, if not a foot away. Then you can also use a variety of different ear sets. Some are better than others. And also talk on a landline like we're doing tonight here. That's the number one thing. And also, don't let your kids have them because of all the alarming data that's out there, it shows that kids' brains are probably more susceptible to these magnetic fields than adults. And unfortunately, the cell phone companies are now marketing cell phones to toddlers.
Oh.
I mean, I'm serious. 2- and 3-year-olds get their first cell phone, and there seems to be no limit to how far the wireless pollution will go.
Do you know those necklaces that people make that allegedly scramble the signals? Do you think those things work?
I've looked at a few of those. I get different opinions. Some people claim they work great. Some people don't really believe in them. I've experimented with a couple different types, and I don't really use anything right now. I used to even wear what was called a Teslar watch, because I was really into Nikola Tesla back in the early days of MRI. And the Teslar watch was supposed to build a protective cocoon around you to ward off the harmful radio frequencies. But it's really hard to prove that these things actually make a difference.
Another thing that interested me in your book, you talked briefly about Bud Brainerd, and in that paragraph you talk about the pineal gland, how it's important in regulating subtle energy systems and states of consciousness. Well, I don't know if you know, but the study of consciousness is one of my passions. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, Bud is another person who has a foot in both worlds. He is, has a undergrad degree in psychology, but then he has graduate degrees in neuroanatomy. And went on to become the an award-winning teacher of neuroscience at Thomas Jefferson University for the medical students. He's also a consultant for NASA on the Mars mission, and he's an expert in both lighting effects on the pineal gland, and also he's up on all the research on magnetic fields as well. And he's also very versed in the Edgar Cayce readings. I mentioned in the book that he did have some transcendental experiences with light as a child, and went and discovered the Cayce readings that gave him some reference as to what he had been experiencing. And Cayce clearly thought the pineal gland was one of the master glands that would influence the soul in powerful ways. And of course, also in the last 20 years, they've discovered it has magnetite crystals in it, and may have other kinds of crystals as well. And I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface of what the pineal gland does. And of course, the joke is that when I was in medical school, the pineal gland was thought to be like the appendix, that it was a vestigial gland that had no purpose. And of course, now we know that the appendix is very important in the neuroimmunology of the gastrointestinal tract. And we're now getting the sense that the pineal gland is the master gland. And Cayce knew that 100 years ago, but we're just catching up now.
So also you talk about studying prayer. Can you tell us about
that? Yeah, at Duke, we did have the Mantra Project, which was run by a friend of mine, Mitch Krukoff, who's a interventional cardiologist. And he put this project together after going to India to an interventional cardiology conference, and had a chance encounter with one of Sai Baba's representatives, who was looking for a cardiologist to consult on his building a state-of-the-art cardiac catheterization lab at his new hospital in India. And Mitch volunteered and went back and had audiences with Sai Baba, and still wears a ring that Sai Baba materialized in his presence. And he became the consultant for the cath lab, and noticed the powerful effects of prayer in that hospital, where basically Sai Baba, who was considered a living deity, would make rounds in the hospital. And he said, oh, this is a place where God comes to visit the patients. So he thought, why not take that back to the Veterans Administration Hospital in Durham, North Carolina, at Duke, where we worked. And he did that, and had wound up with prayer groups from all over the world praying for his patients in the cath lab. It was quite remarkable. There were Tibetans in Nepal. There were Jews at the Wailing Wall. There were Carmelite nuns in Washington, D.C., Moravians in Winston-Salem, all praying for this one group of patients in the Mantra Project. And they wound up coming out with some statistically significant positive effects of prayer on their health outcomes, which and made Time Magazine inside front page news. So that was pretty cool back in the late 90s.
So many scientists will say that that's heresy. Personally, I believe it because I've seen it happen before. But I want to ask you, did the people have to pray a specific prayer in general? Or did y'all differentiate in how they did the prayers, or did they just pray generally, or did they just pray in the highest good? Did they pray
details,
all at the same time, or at different times? Did any of that matter?
You know, looking at different prayer studies shows that sometimes non-specific prayers work better than specific prayers, but I think it varies from research project to project. So.
Can you tell us a little bit about medical intuition?
Sure.
What you found out about that. Is that real?
Yeah, I mean, that is something I'm more certain about than some of these other questions. I started having experiences with medical intuitives actually in about 1990. About 1991 was when I met Carolyn Mace, MYSS, at the Edgar Cayce Center, the Association for Research and Enlightenment. And I had been familiar with Norm Shealy. I had met him earlier, and they've been collaborating on doing research on medical intuition for quite a few years, and had written a very important book way back in the mid-1985, called The Creation of Health, Emerging Intuitive Diagnosis in Conventional Medicine. And that, when I met Carolyn, I immediately asked her if she would do some research with me on to correlate my radiology findings with what she could do from a distance with only a patient's name and age as identifying information. And I did get a chance to do that about a month after our first meeting. And I had just done an MRI scan on a young girl who had severe sciatic pain in her leg. And we did MRIs of her pelvis and spine, and I expected to find nothing, but surprisingly, there was a large tumor on the left side of the pelvis, and it was actually pushing the nerves and growing into the spine, so it was clearly the cause of her pain. And I had left a message on Carolyn's answering machine a couple weeks before, and she'd been out of the country on a trip, and so she got back and actually wound up calling me that afternoon after I had just done the scan on that young girl. And it was a great synchronicity, and the book is actually full of synchronicities. We can talk about that next. But I asked Carolyn if she would do the reading on this young girl, and she initially refused, but then relented and sort of said, "Oh, I'll take a quick look." So I gave her the name and the age and nothing else. I didn't tell her what part of the body I scanned, where her pain was, anything. There was 5 seconds of silence, and then she said, "I see a large tumor in the pelvis working its way into the spine." I was shocked because it was exactly what I had seen on the MRI scan a few hours before. And I was sort of stammered for my next question, but I managed to say, "Please tell me more." And she went on to describe the family history, relationship with the mother, and the fact that she had a severe imbalance of her second chakra and had a fear of going through puberty and all this other stuff. And I was flabbergasted, to be honest. And she was, at first I thought she was just reading my mind, but then it was clear that she was getting more information than I had access to. She even said she was an immature young girl, and I had noticed that even though the requisition said she was 13, that she was only, looked like she was about 9. And so that was an earthquake in my worldview, and that was probably the biggest paradigm-shattering moment in my life. And then it turned out that the girl had a biopsy, and it was, and Carolyn also said it was a malignant tumor. And I thought, well, it's probably a malignant tumor, but it could have been maybe something else. I wasn't 100% sure, but she was pretty definite. She had a biopsy a week later and had a malignant tumor. Probably it was going to have radiation and chemotherapy to her ovaries, so probably wasn't going to have a normal puberty. So all that Carolyn said proved to be 100% correct, and that sent me off on a quest to learn more about medical intuition. And of course, I met you along the way as well and learned more about what you do in medical intuition as well.
So do you believe that it is possible for an intuitive to detect disease before it gets here?
There is a great story in Norman Carolyn's book about her diagnosing colon cancer before it was detected on a barymenema a month later. Now, it may have already been physically present when she detected it, but it wasn't actually diagnosed till months later. I call that prospective intuitive diagnosis. Now, whether or not you can detect things in the energy field and then years later have it manifest as a physical illness, I don't know that anyone's ever actually done that research. It sounds plausible, and it certainly makes sense that things would manifest initially on an energetic level and then eventually on a physical level.
The reason I ask you that question is because when I do readings, I read quite differently than a lot of them. I hear auditorily, so I don't see anything, but mm-hmm. If sometimes I will read for people and I will say, you have such and such, and I'll go, no, I don't. And I'll say, well, do you have this symptom? And they'll say, yes. Do you have that symptom? Yes. And inevitably, even though they'll go to the doctor and check it out and it won't be there, but inevitably within 2 years the person will call me back and say, oh, my God, I have that thing. So that's why I asked that question, because I found it.
Yeah,
and
I guess the tricky thing about that is that in terms of doing research on that, how do we know that the conversation with you didn't precipitate some belief in them that they were going to develop this problem, and it became a self-fulfilling prophecy? Or it would be, in other words, if you hadn't told them and just wrote it down somewhere and given it to their doctor and said, "Don't tell them about this. Let's see what happens," and then it happened 2 years later, that would be a cleaner form of research in terms of proof. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I totally agree. The thing that I find interesting is that there are symptoms that happen long before a disease presents.
Right.
So it makes me wonder if people will pay attention to those subtle symptoms. You know, your brakes don't just go out one day. You know, first they start getting soft. Then they reach this point where they give about, you know, a half an inch. Then they start squealing and they're grinding and they're in the rotors. So if we find it when they're just starting to get soft, could we do something about it then?
Well, actually, that reminds me of another one of my favorite parts of the book, and that's the interest I developed in symptoms as metaphors in the body. And that really started with my dad's illness, having cancer in 1997. And I remember that he used to, he was diagnosed with a large left kidney cancer that was already metastatic when it was diagnosed. But he used to gesture with his hands and talk about his frustrations at work and said, "I feel like I'm building up a big crud ball inside of me of frustration." And he would gesture to the place where the cancer was eventually found. So that was my first introduction to the concept of symptoms as metaphors that might actually have a physical manifestation. And that was just after I had finished reading Bernie Siegel's book as well, that I Love Medicine and Miracles. So I was starting to explore all these mind-body connections. And that was really the initial introduction. Then I found Louise Hay's book, Heal Your Body, in the Metaphysical Bookstore, and I've used that as a guide to any number of symptoms over the years. And it's such a ridiculously simplistic book that you would think that there's no way that any of this stuff could be true. But the more I use the book, the more nuggets of truth I find in it. And I'm sure you're familiar with that book as well.
Yes. That brings up another question. Do you think that particular emotions manifest particular illnesses?
I think there's probably a lot of individual difference based on people's personal genetics and their weak links in their constitution. I do think a lot of these things relate to the five-element theory in Chinese medicine, where you would say fear is associated with the kidneys, anger is associated with the liver, that sort of thing. For me, personally, I can speak from my own symptoms that anger is a big issue I've struggled with over the years, and for me it manifests as shoulder pain. So when my shoulder hurts, now after all these years I know that I'm angry, and I go, okay, what am I angry about? Instead of resisting the symptom and wanting it to go away and suppressing it, and I wound up getting my first experience with severe side effects of pharmaceutical drugs by taking Indocin, which is a very powerful non-steroidal medicine back in residency, actually, and wound up getting mouth ulcers so severe that I couldn't talk or eat. And it took me a week to figure out that, oh, maybe the medicine's causing this. And that was my first introduction to what happens if you try to suppress your symptoms instead of exploring the underlying root cause.
So I know that you've learned a lot of things about acupuncture and about EFT. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I was just connecting it back to reading The Body Electric by Becker. While I was learning all this stuff about electromagnetic fields, I stumbled across in the middle of his book, I think it was page 234, sticks in my head, is the chart he made of the the electrical activity around an acupuncture point. And it's basically a contour map of the skin resistance, showing that the resistance goes down as you get to the center of the point. And there's a little caption under it that says, "This gives acupuncture an objective basis in reality." And for me, that was another paradigm-shifting moment, because it was like, oh, acupuncture points are real, was my immediate conclusion. And I said, I'd like to learn acupuncture someday. So it took me, I'd say, 10 years from the time I made that read that book to 1998, when I finally took the UCLA acupuncture course for physicians. And that was another important moment in shifting my perspective on how the body works, what symptoms mean, and everything else. And it was a wonderful experience. I don't practice much acupuncture now, because I've since moved on to doing emotional freedom techniques, which involves tapping on the acupuncture points while you repeat a negative phrase about a bad experience that you had. And I should mention that while I was learning acupuncture, I was also learning hypnosis and imagery, mostly due to the issue related to claustrophobic patients in the MRI scanner. It was looking for an alternative to strong medications, and we would give people intravenous Valium, which worked great, but sometimes people forget to breathe when they get enough Valium to make them comfortable in the scanner, and you definitely have to keep breathing for the hour that you're in the scanner. So the hypnosis was in parallel with the acupuncture interest. And then in 2002, Cheryl Richardson came to one of our national women's health integrative medicine conferences at Duke and said, oh, you're doing acupuncture and hypnosis, and you're interested in emotional processes. Well, you need to go and learn emotional freedom techniques and download the website from the manual from Gary Craig's website. And that's what I did.
So there's a lot more stories about that
I can go into. So.
Dan Benoit, or you know about his new tapping technique where you don't have to tap particular points, you just got to tap bilaterally while saying those phrases?
Yeah, I've known Dan for years, and he's one of the true pioneers of healing research. As a matter of fact, he wrote three-volume text called Healing Research, and also was one of the first psychiatrists to get into emotional freedom techniques and EMDR, or eye movement reprocessing, eye movement reprocessing, yes. He made a combination hybrid technique called WE, which is, I think, holistic hybrid of EFT and EMDR. Daniel does great work with kids, and we need more.
He's getting married next weekend, by the way, just so you know. If you want to call him and say mazel tov. The other thing I wanted to ask you about: are you aware of Norm Shealy's new machine that uses acupuncture points?
Well, he has quite a few different machines, so we need to specify. I mean, he has many different approaches. Norm has been one of my mentors for years and did write the foreword for my book as well. He invented the TENS device and the dorsal column stimulators way back when he was a mainstream famous neurosurgeon, and then went on to found the first multidisciplinary pain clinic, and since then has been using many different refinements of the TENS machine. One of them is called cranial TENS, where you put it on the head and to influence neurotransmitters, and that's one fascinating line of research all by itself. But he has since then developed protocols for placing TENS devices on different acupuncture points and stimulating the different energetic rings that he's discovered through some of his intuitive explorations: the ring of crystal, the ring of fire, the ring of earth, the ring of water, and they all have different specific effects on neurotransmitters. He's now
That's
gone
exactly
from,
I was talking about. I have one
yeah,
of those
he's
units.
He's gone from electromagnetic using the TENS device to actually putting aromatherapy on these points instead, so you don't have to even use a machine anymore.
What'd you say?
He's now putting aromatherapy on the acupuncture points.
This oil?
essential oils that he has certain formulas for that you put on the acupuncture points, and then you don't even have to use a machine.
Well, I had an amazing experience with that new TENS unit. And, you know, he says that that thing oscillates at 50,000 hertz, which literally treats the soul level.
Yeah.
But I don't know if men have this, but I'm starting to go through menopause. And one of the things that I noticed was that my line of peripheral vision was not as wide as it used to be. And so one day I was fooling with that machine, and I put it, the pad electrodes right down there on that acupuncture by your ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And within 30 seconds, that line of peripheral vision went from being straight ahead to broadening out to the edges of each of my shoulders. I have no idea what that was, but every one of my friends that I put it on that had this, that was, you know, about my age, it did the same, including my daughter, who's only 18, did the same thing. So I don't know what that is, but it did an
amazing. Was that on the inside of your ankle or the outside of your ankle?
The inside. Just below the ankle bone in that little hole there.
Yeah, it's usually where the kidney meridian is, and I know there's some reported visual effects on the lateral meridian, which is on the outside of the ankle. But that I'm sure Norm would be interested in hearing about that.
Told him, and I could hear him flipping through pages looking for that. It was really interesting. So tell us some more about your stories. Did you meet with resistance from your peers?
I think my main strategy over the years is to use humor as much as possible so that my more conservative colleagues wouldn't be able to tell whether I was joking or whether I was really serious about that. And so I would always put it out there as, oh, yeah, I know lots of people who are psychic and can make diagnoses. And they would walk away going, was he serious? Was he joking? You know, and so I'd plant little seeds, and then I would find like-minded colleagues who were would come out of the closet and say, oh, I've been interested in that for years, and I wound up discovering many more open-minded people than I thought. But clearly, in any big medical institution, there's going to be resistance to any sort of change, especially if any of the turf that they've staked out for their personal academic careers is being threatened in any way. And we got the most resistance at Duke from the psychiatrists and the psychologists who were, ironically, the people who were doing the most mind-body work at Duke. But they were concerned that their credibility would be undermined by the alternative medicine group coming in and doing things that they considered flaky and without any research basis, and where they had millions of dollars of NIH grants. So that was one of the biggest challenges. Later on, there were also a couple of real skeptics when I went to present at the curriculum committee to start a course for the medical students. And they took a very antagonistic position and said that whoever taught this course needed to be a skeptic and confronted me with whether I was a skeptic or not. And fortunately, some of my friends on the Integrative Medicine Committee in a program who had more influence than I did wore their white coats to the next meeting, and we prevailed and got the course started. And it took some doing.
Does it continue?
Sorry, what?
Are the students still allowed to be taught this?
They're allowed. Some of the educational programs have dropped off a bit since I left Duke in 2004. And because education is only a priority in as far as there's funding to support it. And we were very fortunate at Duke to have major benefactors who funded the Integrated Medicine Center and in part funded the educational program. That was Christy Mack and Penny George, who were the co-founders of the Bravewell Collaborative, which is the largest philanthropic organization in the country that funds integrative medicine research. And they collaborate with the consortium of academic integrative medicine centers throughout the country, and they have Bravewell Fellows, and that's one avenue for people now who are interested in getting into integrative medicine, is
So are you involved with the RAS
wherever position they are in the medical establishment, and then go to the Bravewell Fellowship for 2 years, and you wind up getting partially trained in Andy Weil's program out in Arizona.
So are you involved in the RAN Research Center?
Yeah, that's the other thing I've been actually more involved with since I left Duke. I've been going to the RAN Center since 1993 when I arrived back at Duke to join the faculty, but really started getting seriously involved as soon as I left Duke in 2004, and was in the board from 2007 to 2008, and still go every other Friday to the RAN Center, to the talks they have with people from all over the country. Probably many of the people I see listed on your program on the page for your Infinite Consciousness website and show. Edgar Mitchell's been here. Claude Swanson's been here. Dean Radin's been here. Gary Schwartz has been here. So, yes, many of those people we share common connections to.
So what is it that you do there? What does that research center do?
Right now, our most first of all, they publish the Journal of Parapsychology, so that's the main forum for parapsychologists from all over the world, and we just had the international meeting of the Parapsychology Association here in Durham 2 weekends ago, which was a lot of fun to meet great parapsychologists from all over the world. The RAN Center has done a variety of different research, interesting research projects over the years, from the Gonsfeld project to remote viewing to a variety of other things. The most impressive research at the moment is done by my friend Bill Joynes, who's actually a full professor of electrical engineering at Duke. And he's, for the last 30 years, he's been studying a healer's ability to emit light when they're in the act of healing. And he was doing this in the 70s. The most famous story is that he put a healer from the RAN Center into the dark room in the basement of the engineering school, and put a graduate student in the dark room to get dark adapted, even though there's no light at all in the room. And then they put sensitive photometers in the room with the healer and the graduate student. And then after an hour, said, "Okay, charge up the healing energy." And the graduate student yells, "She's glowing in the dark," and runs out of the room. And the meters all went off and showed that she had emitted light from her body. And that was 30-some years ago. Now,
so we've got about 10 minutes left.
Yeah, have you? I don't know if you'd heard that story before.
I'd not heard that story, but I had heard the story about Fritz Papp and the corn seedling.
Okay. Well, the good news is that lately Bill and John Kruse, the new executive director at the RAN Center, have been replicating that research, and they find if they put just a person in the room with just sitting there and doing nothing, they put out about 10 photons per second from their body. If they meditate, it goes up to 50. But he's had some healers that they put in the room have put out over 1 million photons per second.
Really?
And that's very impressive data. And one of them is actually a Georgia guy from down near you, Ed Edwards. I don't know if you've come across
him. Oh, yeah, no, he lives in my city.
Yeah, Ed Edwards, yeah. Ed with two D's, EDD. He's putting out over a million photons per second when he's doing his healing work, so that was pretty cool.
That's amazing. So do you have any research on Ed as changing cellular structure?
Well, right now we're just measuring the light coming out. Other people, I think, have been studying Ed's healing effects. And we haven't connected the output of light yet to any specific healing effects, but I think that'll probably be one of the next stages in the research.
That's amazing. Yeah, he lives right down the street from me, actually. Right across the street from Mark Flick. We were talking about him earlier. So we have 10 minutes left. Talk about anything that you want to talk about you think is important that we haven't, or even if we have.
Well, I thought about your comment about when your brakes start to fail, and it reminded me of my favorite teaching story from my Michael Greenwood, who was one of my acupuncture teachers. And he said, the situation we have now in our culture is that we want to suppress symptoms no matter what the cost. cost in terms of money, cost in terms of side effects of drugs, but that's our number one priority, is suppress those symptoms. And it's like, and like you said, if your brakes are squeaking a little bit, we just want to get rid of that squeak no matter what. We don't care about the long-term effects. And Michael Greenwood's story is, okay, you've got a really brand new sports car that you're really proud of, and you drive it off the lot, drive it around for a couple of days, then all of a sudden the red oil light comes on. And you look in the owner's manual, it says, you can turn the car off and turn it back on again. If the light comes back on again, you need to take it to the shop right away because it could cause serious damage to your engine. So the light's still on, you take it into the shop, and the mechanic comes out and says, I'm very intimately familiar with the electrical system in this car. I'll have this handled in no time. Takes it in the back of the shop, cuts the wire that goes to your red light, and gives it back to you. And then you drive it off, and God knows what happens to your car next. So if we think that sounds like mechanic malpractice, and that would be a crazy thing to do, why do we do the same thing with our bodies every day? By putting, basically drugs that are just basically cutting the wires that are sending the signal.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, I'm so anti-pharmaceutical. I mean, they certainly have their place, but I have a little boy right now that has ADHD, and some days he almost drives me crazy. Now, I was talking to this woman the other day, Joan Matthews Larson, who wrote this book, Depression Weeks and Depression, Cure Depression 7 Weeks or something like that, without drugs. She said, take a teaspoon of barrage oil and put it on his skin because he won't take pills. He's 12, hates pills. Put it on his skin. So I did. And in about 15 minutes, he said, Mom, what did you give me? My brain shut up. He said, all that chattering that's going on in my brain, just shut up. But the interesting thing about it, he started school last Monday this year, and I took this barrage oil to the school, and they won't allow me to put it on him.
Well, I've heard similar stories like that. Now you're getting into the whole area of functional medicine as well, and I think these two things that we're talking about actually really play hand in hand. One is acknowledging that your body's giving you a message, and it might be an emotional trauma that you need to deal with something like emotional freedom techniques, or it might be a deficiency in some nutrient, and that then you're getting into the field of functional medicine. But really, taking a drug is often the last thing you want to do, because you're just shooting the messenger, and the damage is going to keep going on until you either deal with the emotional trauma that's at the root of it, or you deal with the nutritional deficiency. So those two things.
They said to me, bring us a prescription, and I even got a prescription for it, and they still wouldn't let me do it. They said, if you bring us a prescription of Ritalin or Adderall, we'll give him that. But they would not let me give him barrage oil on his skin.
And the insurance company's probably not going to pay for his neurofeedback that will retrain his brain how to work properly either. So. When I look at all the good options we have these days for dealing with symptoms and respecting the symptoms as an important messenger from our subconscious, that our body's trying to tell us something, and until we pay attention in the proper way, it's going to keep bothering us. It's like you said, the brakes are going to get squeakier and squeakier until they fall off, and then you're going to have a major physical illness that you're going to have surgery for, something else, because you didn't pay attention to the subtle symptoms that were coming along the way. So.
Yeah. All right, we've got 5 minutes. Do you want to tell us again where people can find you and any other thing that we've left out?
Yes, at www.letmagichappen.com, and the book is Let Magic Happen, Adventures in Healing with a Holistic Radiologist. And on the website, there's also a newsletter that I have every month. And I'm going to be highlighting a different chapter every month for the next year or so. And I'm also teaching 10 techniques in the appendix, my favorite mind-body-spirit techniques, such as intuitive diagnosis and imagery and a variety of other techniques that you can learn. And I'm going to be highlighting each one of those techniques during the months to come. And there's also a blog where I have a short YouTube video every month. And you can also learn my approach to emotional freedom techniques, which we haven't talked about that much tonight, but it's clearly my favorite approach to dealing with almost any kind of bad experience in the past that is causing some health problem now.
So why don't you take this last 5 minutes and talk about that?
Yeah. So
and synchronicity.
Basically, tapping on the acupuncture meridian while you're repeating a negative a phrase about a negative experience you've had in the past. And it's actually possible to delete that experience out of your body. And I tell people when the trauma happens, it's like you have a software program installed in your meridian system that goes up to your brain and stores it in your limbic system and the hippocampus. And anytime you think about, anytime you open that file, think about that past memory, opens up that file, runs the program, and you feel it in your body again. And the idea is to start tapping on the acupuncture meridians when you open the file, like you're hitting the delete key over and over again. And you eventually, you can clear it out of your system within a matter of minutes.
Do you have to touch a particular acupuncture point or just anyone?
There are major acupuncture points on the face and the chest, and there's a handout on my website which goes through it, and you can, EFT is taught all over the world, and everybody has their own version of it. Mine you'll find on the website. But it works for everything from stage fright, public speaking anxiety, because your grade school teacher yelled at you when you were in the school play, or works for military PTSD from veterans coming back from the war, works for fear of small animals and phobias about bugs. It works for anxiety about flying on a plane. And sometimes I usually do one or two sessions with people, and whatever they're dealing with is pretty much gone, and they even forget they've had it sometimes.
So let me ask you this. My little boy, the one that has the ADHD,
mm-hmm.
What if he doesn't know what it is that's bothering him? He has had trauma in his life, but what if he can't zero in on that trauma? Which one would we tap on, and what would we see?
Yeah, just tap on, sort of whatever it is that happened to me that I don't remember. I mean, you can sort of go back, and sometimes if you tap for a while, you'll uncover what it is that needs to be cleared. And it's a little bit of a detective story in the process, but working one-on-one with someone who has some experience, could probably get to the root of it and could be really helpful.
That's really interesting. And we got 2 or 3 minutes. You want to talk a minute about synchronicities?
Oh, yeah. I think that's the other main message in the book, is my entire life's been guided by synchronicities. And finding the right book at the right time, meeting the right person at the right time. And the most interesting ones are probably called double synchronicities. That's when an ordinary synchronicity that you would have happens at the same time as another one, simultaneously in the same place. For me, it happens in elevators. It's happened in wrestling rooms. It's happened in bookstores. But when two extremely unlikely events happen at the same time simultaneously and are connected, that to me is proof that there's something more mysterious about the universe than we currently understand, and that brings the whole discussion of consciousness and manifestation up, which I'm sure you talk about on other shows.
Yeah, we do. So do you believe that synchronicities are like guideposts that you're on the right path, doing the right
Absolutely.
Thing, or in the right place?
And some people
at the
even
right
say
time,
that they're God's way
the
of remaining
right
anonymous. Send you synchronicities, and if you receive them properly, your faith will be enhanced that things are going to work out.
I love it. I love those things.
And then you can say, let magic happen. And that's really what I'm talking about when I say let magic happen.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Burt, for taking the time to come on my show. I am going to call you in a few minutes and give you some other bookstores that would be more than glad to carry your books so we can get them in there and maybe do some book signings, just so you'll have that for yourself, if you don't mind, because I think it's a very powerful and important book. So thanks again for taking the time, and you did a great job. And everybody, please, please get a copy of this. It may be one of those books that changes your life. And have a good night.
Well, thank you so much, Eva. I appreciate the opportunity to share with your guests.
Thank you. Good night.